when you produce nature films in the world's largest format,
we want to take audiences into an environment, places they're probably never going to get to see things they're never going to experience.
IMAX filmmaker Mike Day tells us how he's traveled the world to bring back the spectacles of nature, but at 10 times bigger than life. Teresa Bruce searched for lost childhood memories of a family road trip to South America by taking a van down the longest highway in the world.
You're literally passing through North America, Central America, and South America on one stretch of road.
She found that understanding the lives of the people she met was her best souvenir.
But the longer you drive, the more willing and able you are to kind of roll with those changes and appreciate the sacrifices that people make to live there.
And listeners share how their hobbies and special interests can boost their travel plans. Stay with us for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. What's it take to produce a stunning nature documentary that'll really light up those huge IMAX theater screens around the world? Filmmaker Mike Day joins us in just a bit on today's Travel with Rick Steves to share what it's been like. And we'll check in with listeners like you for reports on how they've enjoyed international travels designed around their hobbies and special interests. Let's start with a look at an ambitious road trip Teresa Bruce and her husband took across Central and South America. In an earlier edition of Travel with Rick Steves, Teresa told us why she felt she needed to retrace an epic 1974 family road trip down the Pan-American Highway. She's back with us to tell us more about how this time they actually got their camper to make it all the way to the tip of South America. Teresa, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
If you were in the United States, is this the idea you can just get on this road and keep going south and eventually get to Tierra del Fuego?
You can, and that's part of the appeal. I mean, you're literally passing through North America, Central America, and South America on one stretch of road. Except there is a break right in the middle at Panama. There's what's known as the Darien Gap, and the Pan-American Highway does not cross that. In fact, you still can't really get through. I think there was an exploration attempt, but it's jungle, it's in disputed territory. So at the very end of Central America, you have to find ocean passage to get your rig to South America. And that's what we did. We found a roll-on, roll-off container ship that took our camper, and then we met it on the other side in Manta, Ecuador. It took us at least 3 weeks to try and secure passage. Those ships only leave when there's enough cargo.
Oh.
And, you know, some go to Colombia and some go to Venezuela and some go to Ecuador. And you have to make the determination of, you know, where it's safe to go. There's all kinds of different ways that you can secure passage. You used to be able to actually ride with your vehicle on those crossings. But after 9/11, you can't. So it's quite logistically challenging. That was definitely the hardest part logistically of the drive down the Pan-American Highway.
So you look at the map and Panama is an isthmus, and it, you know, meaning you can get across. But in actuality, if you're driving, it's not an isthmus. You've got Central America and you've got South America and you've got to find a way around.
Yes. And the camping along the Pan-American Highway really sort of stops after Mexico. There's no formal campground system until you get to Argentina, where every town has a central campground. And it's wonderful. There's a camping and driving culture in Argentina that makes it much easier. So if you make it all the way to Argentina, you will be rewarded, drivers out there.
And what do you do in the interim? I mean, north of Argentina, you just stay in roadside motels?
In Latin America and South America, it was a little different. In Central America, sometimes it was too hot to actually sleep inside a camper that was old and didn't have air conditioning. So we would pay a hotel to let us just park the rig in their parking lot and maybe use the shower. Mm-hmm. Once we got to South America, even that level of travel infrastructure was harder to come by. So generally, you would just try and find a farm or a gas station or something and ask the owners of the land if it was okay if you parked your vehicle for the night and offer some sort of payment. And that was a great way to meet people and to really see how real people in the continent live. And, you know, you're not always going to have a level parking situation. You're not going to have any facilities, but you're really out there experiencing it.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Teresa Bruce, and she's written a book called The Drive, Searching for Lost Memories on the Pan-American Highway, that describes her epic road trip from Oregon all the way down to Tierra del Fuego. And Teresa, you write that in Latin America, you found it felt just as safe as North America, and that
commercial news is what skews our perception so much. I just find that so hard to believe. It's funny how the image of driving through Latin America is just one of danger. Is it just because we're thinking about bandidos and drug lords and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or what's the deal?
I think, and it's just fear of the unknown. Latin America isn't really in our consciousness unless we're seeing negative news about it. And what we found was the exact opposite. Now, the roads, I'm going to tell you, they're not great. So we had four-wheel drive, and that helped in many situations. And, you know, crossing the borders is as much of a communication challenge as it is anything else. But it really wasn't. We were never physically threatened. But one piece of advice I would give people who do long road trips like that is we took a pledge, my husband and I, that if either one of us at any point along this long, long road trip really got spooked, really felt like we were in danger or that a situation just looked like there wasn't a good escape route, our pledge was to trust each other's instincts. And if someone had that feeling, then you would turn around and drive away without questioning and without argument. And that, just taking that pledge as a traveler, is really what calms you down and lets you realize that you actually aren't in danger and that you can avoid bad decisions.
You're driving over 13 borders, encountering police and corruption and briberies. What was your contact with the local police, and to what degree did you need to know the whole bribing culture?
Well, I had a bit of experience having done this as a child. But, you know, at first we fought the bribe, the mordita. The word in Spanish means like little bite. And it's just so irritating. You know, it's not the way things work in our culture. But gradually, when you travel through enough countries in Central and South America and you see the poverty and you see the living conditions, you realize that it's just part of the system. It's just part of the privilege you pay to be able to drive through in relative luxury and just to satisfy your curiosity. And so we started thinking of them as donations instead. And you can't really fight it unless you want to get thrown in jail or have some sort of confrontation. And it's really not worth it. It's just about the experience and
the bribes are not going to break the bank, or is it like 20 or 40 bucks or something?
Exactly. And you do pay some creative ones. You pay people not to have a lunch break right when you arrive, or you pay people not to run out of paper. It's those kinds of things that you just have to kind of turn your perspective and imagine it from theirs.
I remember going on the sort of hippie bus road from Istanbul all the way to Kathmandu, and After a while, I sort of measured how far we had yet to go by how many borders we had yet to cross. It was no problem going cross country, but the big stressful moments were crossing those borders. That's where you had to deal with the bureaucrats and the police and the searches and all that.
Exactly.
Did you have that kind of feeling in South America? You crossed 13 borders. Was it sort of like a mystery, upcoming this next border? Do we need to hire somebody to shepherd us through? Do we have a big delay? Do we have all the documentation we need?
That is the least fun part of a big road trip through South America. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's this great word for kids sort of flood your vehicle when you pull up to an overland border crossing, and they jump on and they're called tramadores, which sounds traumatizing, but that is really
and
what they're trying
the
to skids. Do.
They get you through?
Exactly. You pay them off, and that's what you do.
And then the roads. You write about how in Bolivia the roads are so bad that if you take a taxi, it'll leave you on the main square just so they don't have to drive down the little lanes that'll mess up their tires. What were the roads like? I think Bolivia is most famous for bad roads, isn't it?
It is. And some people actually go for just that reason, the thrill of it. I'm not so thrilled by these terrible roads, but sometimes it's inevitable. In Bolivia, when we were traveling, the main highways and bridges had been washed out in a flood. And so we were forced to literally drive over what they called carriage route. And what that really meant, once you sort of left pavement to gravel to cobblestone, and then it was just ruts across the Altiplano, and they were the actual wagon routes that people and merchants and villagers would use to sell goods from village to village. So the roads in Bolivia are every bit as bad as you'd imagine.
Did you ford streams? Were there times where you had to wish there was a bridge?
Yes, one time in Bolivia. It's all in Bolivia, I think. The bridge was washed out, and so we were sort of stopped in the road going, what do we do? And this big semi-truck just pulled right around us, went down the embankment, drove along the river, drove up and crossed over a single railroad trestle. And we went, that's what they do. So we just followed along, and it was so narrow that I had to get out and walk backwards over these planks, motioning Gary so that he knew to come a little to the left or a little to the right as we crossed this raging river. And so those are the things that you have to learn to go with the flow.
And then you complement that with high altitude. Don't some of the roads just go like where you're actually in thin air?
You are. The highest point that we crossed was in Peru at around 15,000 feet.
Driving 15,000 feet, that's taller than Mount Rainier.
It is. It's incredible. And what happens when you do it in a day is that you're not even really cognizant of it, because we had a great vehicle, a Ford F-350. It could handle it better than we could. But we took a break at the top at around 15,000 feet, and we tried to make lunch, and we thought we'd go for a walk. And we didn't even realize how dazed we were. Mm. And at one point, you know, my husband's trying to take a picture, but he can't really stand up straight. And he says, look, they're over. And he's pointing to a shallow lake, and there's flamingos. It's like surreal. Why are there flamingos up here? They belong like in someone's grassy front yard in Florida, not at the top of the world. But they were feeding on the salt flats at the top of this pass.
At 15,000 feet.
At 15,000 feet.
Teresa Bruce proves to us that you can go back. She writes about her two trips down the Pan American Highway, once as a young child in the 1970s, and then 30 years later with her husband. Her book is called The Drive, Searching for Lost Memories on the Pan American Highway. Teresa, you crossed 13 borders and a lot of poverty, but not uniform poverty. To what degree did you notice a difference of affluence from country to country and a difference of infrastructure and comfort level for a North American traveler?
There was a monumental shift south of Ecuador and Peru and Bolivia. That's where, I mean, these are some of the poorest countries in the world. And it's a huge attitude check. I mean, when you're driving through deserts and through borders where there are people in reed mat huts that just look like little cubes they've made in the desert, and it's all in the hopes that someday that land will be valuable and they can lay a claim to it and there might be water there. And so, you know, you definitely see more poverty, more isolation the farther south you get, but also more beauty and more a chance to just really open up and experience something completely unlike anything you will in North America.
But then does the affluence level rise in Argentina?
Yes, by the time we hit Argentina, not the northern part, that's still pretty isolated. But, you know, when you get into sort of Mendoza and the winemaking country, there is more of a calmness. It's more familiar and there's more of an infrastructure. There are campgrounds in every town and the roads are better until you get to Patagonia. So, yeah, it changes as you go. But the longer you drive, the more willing and able you are to kind of roll with those changes and appreciate the sacrifices that people make to live there.
Sounds like an adventure. Teresa Bruce, thanks so much for writing The Drive and sharing with us a little insight into what may be the ultimate road trip, the Pan American Highway. Happy travels, Teresa.
Thank you.
Teresa Bruce is the author of The Drive, Searching for Lost Memories on the Pan American Highway. She includes photos on her website, teresabruce.me. Mike Day describes how exhilarating travels turned into spectacular nature films, next on Travel with Rick Steves. Mike Day has spent his career inspiring people to learn about and to connect with our world. As an IMAX documentary filmmaker, his work has taken him to some of the world's most interesting and photogenic places, like the world's tallest sand dunes in Namibia, tuna auctions in Tokyo, active volcanoes along the Ring of Fire, and even to Jane Goodall's primate research site in Africa. Mike's concluded that one of the best things we can do for ourselves is to travel outside of our comfort zones and let it broaden our perspectives. Mike writes about his experiences in his book, The World Has a Big Backyard, and he joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves. Mike, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Rick. It's a privilege to be with you.
You know, you start off in your book with a quote from Anthony Bourdain, and the quote is, "Travel isn't always pretty, it isn't always comfortable, but that's okay." Why does this quote resonate so much with you?
Well, you know, in writing this book, it's certainly the memoir of all of the great travel experiences I've had producing documentary films and shooting in the world's largest film format, IMAX. But the book has a purpose as well. And what was great was my publisher, the company Wise Inc. in Minneapolis, they publish books with a purpose. So they believed in my purpose, which is simply to create a journey of self-development for the reader of the book to inspire them to have a mindset for more interesting and authentic travel experiences. Or as I ask, why go to an amusement park when you can go to an erupting volcano? And I think this is very much in line with what you have sometimes said is your mission, Rick, which is to equip Americans to venture beyond Orlando.
Yeah, I was just, as I was reading through your book, Mike, first of all, I thought, well, this is a great collection of travel experiences. And then I thought, it's also a, kind of a philosophy of travel book. And the more I read it, the more I realized it was really both. We're kind of birds of a feather that way. I joke, my favorite towns on the Italian Riviera are national parks where nobody can change any of their buildings. And that means there's no comfortable hotels. And that's good news because it keeps away the most obnoxious slice of the traveling public, people who insist on good hotels. Anthony Bourdain was talking about that. You're talking about it. It's a takeaway we get from good travel. And you're talking about looking at culture shock as something that is not to be avoided.
Right, absolutely. And I understand that, you know, travel can have a great deal of uncertainty, unpredictability, uncontrollability. So I also, at the same time in my book, try and give people tips, things that I have learned along the way that will help them have those authentic experiences and deal with that uncertainty and unpredictability.
Okay, a good example of that might be Cuba. You've done work in Cuba. You made an IMAX film set in Cuba. How did that put you into a world of uncertainty where comfort is not always king?
Well, the thing that I've learned most importantly is to have respect. Have respect for the place, have respect for the people, but also remember to have respect for yourself. And that means taking care of yourself, not just your physical needs, make sure you get enough rest, drink enough water, but you also, of course, have emotional, spiritual, and social needs as well that you'll want to take care of. So example, emotional. I always say, and I say this in my book, practice mindfulness. In other words, suspend your immediate judgment. Don't overreact. Simply unlock your curiosity. And another tip, don't fear wrong turns, because as you know, Rick, some of the best travel experiences are those that are completely unplanned.
You know, speaking of mindfulness, you wrote that you found a moment of mindfulness at a bullfight. That's an interesting place to find a spirit of mindfulness. Tell us about that.
Yeah, what happened was I was with a group of industry people, museum people from around the world, and we were being hosted by the museums in Valencia. They took us to the bullfights. Many of those in attendance, like myself, were from the U.S., and we had never experienced a bullfight. And of course, after the first bullfight, and as is always the case, the bull loses the fight, you know, it can be quite disturbing to people. It's a bloody, kind of gory activity. And many of the people from the U.S. said, I've had enough, and they got up and they left. And that's where I, at that moment, said, no, practice mindfulness. Suspend your immediate judgment. Don't overreact. Unlock your curiosity. Stay in your seat. And the people that remained, I found to be some of the most interesting people that I was actually traveling with. And it led to all sorts of interesting things after that.
And you don't need to embrace it. You don't need to endorse it, but you can experience it. That's not sinful, you know,
and it can change you.
Yeah. We're getting an extra large view of the world with film producer Mike Day right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Mike's a former museum executive, and he's collected lessons and stories from his world travels in his book, The World Has a Big Backyard, Adventure Travel Stories from an IMAX Documentary Filmmaker. Mike's film titles include Tornado Alley, Jane Goodall's Wild Chimpanzees, and Ring of Fire. His website is mikedaytravels.com. Mike, I love nature documentaries. I can just watch them forever. And you've done some nature documentaries. I don't think your viewers often appreciate the difficulty that goes into making a good nature documentary. What are some of the challenges that you wish the people who just sit there relaxing and enjoying it should appreciate?
Well, they're especially challenging if you're shooting in the world's largest film format, IMAX. Fortunately, now we have converted from shooting with film to doing it with digital cameras. But boy, in the early days, IMAX, the cameras were big, the cameras were noisy, The magazines only held 3 minutes of film. So imagine that, you know, you're shooting underwater, as we did for a film entitled Search for the Great Sharks. Mm-hmm. You shoot 3 minutes of film, then all the crew members have to come topside. The camera has to come topside. You have to take the camera out of the underwater housing. You have to carefully unload the film, carefully reload the film back in the underwater housing. Everybody back in their scuba gear, back in the water. And, you know, some things you just have to wait. You just have to be patient. And that's, I'm like you. I watch documentary films and I just applaud them because I can see the patience and the time that has been required to capture what you're seeing on the screen.
I have a sense that you and I are about the same age and we've been filming about the same amount of time. And hasn't it been a beautiful window to see the technological improvements that enable us to do our work now compared to when we started?
Yeah, the digital format is great. I mean, we used to, of course, have to rig up IMAX cameras, the film cameras, you know, with mounts on helicopters, and you had to work so hard to make sure it was stabilized. Yeah. And now we can take those smaller digital cameras and put them on a drone, and we just get magical footage now that we just couldn't get in the past.
Can you, for people that have heard the word IMAX but don't really know what it is, tell us just technically, what is IMAX film? And then also tell us the business model. Is it only in certain theaters? Is it then seen without IMAX in any old theater? Is it a booming business or is it fading away as we go from broadcast to streaming and so on?
IMAX stands for Image Maximum, and it was a group of Canadians out of the Toronto area that first created the format. World's largest film frame, 10 times the size of standard 35 millimeter. So there was a whole lot more information on every frame. One of the keys, though, was to make sure that as you were filming or projecting, that each frame was in the same location as the frame before or the frame after, because you couldn't have any jitter because you were magnifying the image more than 500 times.
Oh, so you're magnifying the detail as well as the jitter. So if you got more detail, you also have more jitter.
Yeah, and you have to avoid that jitter. So the quality of the film projection was just superb, nothing like it. Well, today, and thanks to some film directors, primarily Christopher Nolan, who is always shooting still with IMAX film versus IMAX digital, we have evolved to where there are now more than 1,700 theaters worldwide. There's been great growth in China and in India, more than 1,700 IMAX theaters. But it has to say IMAX for it to be a true IMAX theater. And it's not only big screen, high quality imagery, but the sound systems are outstanding. You're going into a theater now that has 12 different loudspeaker clusters. And just as IMAX engineered the cameras and the projectors from the ground up, their sound systems are all original design from the ground up.
I hadn't thought about that, but if you're going to get great visuals, you want great audio also. And that's part of it, apparently.
Yeah, if you talk to anybody in the IMAX business who works on the audio side, when they hear somebody say, you know, it's 75% image, 25% audio, they'll say, no. It's at least 50-50 audio and imagery. And it is both. And it is what's remarkable about the IMAX experience.
So an IMAX production is more expensive, I would imagine. And the market is, it sounds like it's smaller. You have to really commit yourself to a destination if you're going to choose to make an IMAX production there. What's your thinking about looking for a location that merits IMAX coverage?
Yeah, pre-planning really helps to have a successful production, but looking for that subject and that story that works on a giant screen. So, for example, one of the last films I did is a film called Ancient Caves. It's the story of a young English woman who goes into caves, brings out stalagmites. If you cut them in half, you have growth rings, like tree rings. And you take geologic samples and you can put it in a mass spectrometer and tell what the atmosphere was at a certain period of time. In other words, this person's work is remapping the climate history of the planet over the last half million years. Well, what could be a more perfect story, especially for a science museum IMAX theater? a great contemporary science story, but also we want to take audiences into an environment, places they're probably never going to get to see things they're never going to experience. So taking them into caves, especially underwater caves, was just the perfect subject for the format. It's as though this story, this little science story, is perfect for the format, perfect for the setting of a museum, perfect for what is in essence a 45-minute film. And that's what we were always looking for, is what's the right story with the right places that works for the format, and it works best in this format.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Mike Day, and he's been the executive producer of more than a dozen IMAX film documentaries. He compiles his lessons from traveling the world in his book, The World Has a Big Backyard. You can find out more about Mike in the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. So, Mike, we were talking about nature documentaries. I'm just dying to see your film about the tropical rainforest. What is the most inspiring natural setting you can recall as a producer when it comes to doing these kind of documentaries?
A couple of places that, you know, I didn't know about before we went looking to make these films. One is the film we did on the Ring of Fire, the southern main island of Kyushu in Japan. You go down to the southern tip to the town of Kagoshima, and you are there at the Sakurajima volcano. This volcano has been in active explosion since the 1950s, and it generally will explode more than once a day. Just the other day, as a matter of fact, I read where there was an ash explosion that went 4 miles into the sky. So the volcano sits in a bay of the East China Sea. Across the bay is the city of Kagoshima. So if you go and check into the Kagoshima Sun Royal Hotel, make sure you ask for a volcano side room so you can sit on your balcony and just watch it. Doing the tropical rainforest film that you mentioned, it was really interesting to go down to Corcovado, a national park in Costa Rica. And at the time we went, there were no roads to get there. The ocean seashore was too rugged to land a boat, so they had cut out a little swatch of the rainforest to land single-engine planes. And when we went there to scout it as a location, you register like you would do at a national park, and you pay your fee. And I went through the registration book. The park had been in existence for 10 years, and the average number of visitors each year was only 300 people. That's a lot less than visit a place like Yellowstone every year. So it was a privilege to be there early in its history and when so few people had been there. But I have to be honest, Rick, Corcovado National Park never ended up in our film. We went there on a scouting trip and determined it would be too hard logistically to bring in a film crew and have to build all the infrastructure to actually shoot at that location. But I got to see it.
What about some of your favorite places that you've filmed that made you want to return without the crew to really, really experience it? Just to wrap up our interview right now, tell me about a place that you worked where you wanted to go back and really do it on your own.
Well, I did a lot of work in Japan, and I always enjoyed the work there. But it's as you describe, you are working, which in one respect, you know, immerses you into the culture in a very interesting way. But also at the same time, you'd like to be able to step out of that work mode. Well, the good news is, and I'm a big believer that the best gift you can give, the gift to yourself, the best gift you can give to someone else, and especially the best gift that you can give to young people is travel. So I have a nephew who, my thing with him, starting when he was 8 years old, I was going to take him on a trip every spring break. And the first year I took him to my hometown of Chicago. He lives in St. Paul. Great first place to visit for a kid that age. At age 9, we went to St. Louis. And when he was 10, I figured he was old enough. So I asked him, where would you like to go? And he said, New York or Tokyo? And I said, great. We went to New York when he was 10, and I finally got to Japan, not working, when he was 12, and the two of us went to Tokyo and just had a wonderful travel experience. Now, you talk about travel experiences for young people. You can give them a gift of something, some electronic device, and, you know, it's going to wane the interest over time or wear out. But as you know, travel can provide lifetime memories. And I have to tell you, this 12-year-old kid I took is now in his 20s. We went in March when the cherry blossoms were in bloom. He came to me a couple of weeks ago, and he pulled up his pants leg to show me his new tattoo on his calf. It was a Tokyo palace with a samurai warrior and cherry blossom petals floating down his leg. There's the proof. This thing has created a lifetime memory for him, his trip to where he wanted to go, Japan. So wow. I'm always ready to take a niece or nephew to where they want to go.
My goodness, if everybody had an uncle like Mike Day, I think not only would we have a lot of curious and broad-minded people, but this world would be a better place. And Mike, thanks for bringing the world home so vividly in your work as an IMAX documentary filmmaker.
Thank you, Rick. A pleasure.
Mike Day describes his adventures making IMAX nature documentaries in his memoir, The World Has a Big Backyard. In an earlier visit with us, Mike confessed to being an umbraphile and shared why it's been worth the effort to travel the world to view a total solar eclipse. You can hear that on program number 749 from March of 2024. It's in our show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. Let's check in with listeners next at 877-333-7425. How have your interests and passions helped to design memorable travels overseas? Did they turn into something of a pilgrimage or maybe a scavenger hunt? You can also share your travel reports with us by email to radio@ricksteves.com. We all travel with different passions and different aspirations. And if you've got a hobby or a special interest, and if you can weave it into your trip, it just becomes a better trip. Right now, we're going to talk with our travelers, with our audience, with our listeners, and we're going to share ideas about hobbies and how special interests can sort of, you know, I like to say the word carbonate the experience. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. You can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. Let's talk about hobbies and special interests. Let's talk to Mark in Albany, California. Mark, thanks for your call.
Oh, thanks for taking my call, Rick. Thank you very much. I'm a big sports fan. I was a sports writer for about 25 years, and whenever I go to Europe or to any other country, I seek out sporting events. You know, whether it's a bullfight or a baseball game or even a good chess match, I look ahead of time to find a sporting event that I think would be fascinating to see, and I think it's paid off. Is I've really enjoyed those types of endeavors internationally.
You know, I think that's one of the great oversights of among travelers is not to realize that you don't need to be a fanatic about soccer to have a really entertaining experience going to a soccer match, or you don't need to be really into greyhound racing to actually go to a greyhound race. There's so many sporting events, and they vary really dramatically from country to country, don't they?
Oh, and they do. And it's not only the sporting event, but it's the people. It's the arenas are different.
The snacks,
even the concessions.
Yeah,
I remember being in Japan at a baseball game, sitting up in the nosebleed seats, and this tiny concessionaire had a keg on her back. It probably weighed 35 pounds, and she's like a mountain goat, and she's pouring beers for people. And it's like, that's something you don't see in the U.S.
No. Wow. Every culture has these. And, you know, I would propose going to sports that you don't know the rules to, just for something entirely
that's
different.
A great idea.
And most people in the stands would love to be your mentor to better appreciate hurling in Ireland or that wonderful highlight sport in Basque country and so on.
Oh, I totally agree. And you can even take it one step further. And if you're like myself, I'm an avid sports memorabilia collector, and you can take it to like the sales of the markets, and you can find in Europe and beyond all sorts of fun stuff like Olympic stamps and tickets and credentials and soccer cards. And it's just there's so much out there for the sports fan or just someone who's interested
to
take advantage.
What about touring stadiums? I know that's a big deal for a lot of soccer people. I mean, a lot of people will, it's almost like a religious pilgrimage to go to some, you know, revered stadium for soccer.
I completely agree that going to the stadiums that have held the World Cups just the ones that have been around for 100 years or more to see a match there, much like people do in the U.S., making a tour around the country. It probably bullfight arenas are the same way, or even golf courses. It's hitting the major golf courses that hold the British Open.
Yeah,
has got to be on high in people's lists.
And bars. I mean, you go to a bullfight bar in Spain, and it's almost as graphic as going to the bullfight itself.
I was going to bring that up. The sports bars that are near the stadiums, they're just as fanatic. I was fortunate enough to be in Japan when Ichiro was playing his last major league games, and it was held at the Tokyo Dome. And it was just nuts around the stadium and in the bars. It was a spectacle. It was wonderful to be there.
You know, Mark, one thing I would mention to people is don't insist on going to the big stadiums for the major leagues of whatever sport we're talking about. I find very charming the little small town versions. I mean, you can go to a small town bullfight, and it's just a simple little tiny, almost like a, it's sort of an inflatable swimming pool as opposed to a serious swimming pool, the bull arena. You know, there's little stadiums for soccer. I've been to, you know, a big soccer game. Sometimes it's expensive and overwhelming with the crowds and hard to get a ticket. But there's small towns that have soccer matches, and it's for real, just like going to a minor league baseball game here.
I was going to say that in countries like the Netherlands or Australia or in Italy, they have their own versions of baseball, and it may be sort of like club level or
right.
like low college, but it's just as exciting, just as interactive, and I think it'd be a thrill for a sports fan to attend.
Mark from Albany, California, thanks so much for reminding us that we have that whole different dimension of checking in with the culture in our travels, and that would be becoming a sport enthusiast for whatever sport you don't know anything about.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
Take care. Happy travels. Becca's calling in from Arlington in Virginia. Hey, Becca.
Hey, Rick.
Thanks for calling. What do you have in mind?
So I'm a foodie. I love to bake, and I also love to eat. And so I knew about a couple of years ago that got really popular, this pastry called Queen Amand. It's not spelled that way, but it's a good French or Brittany word, Breton word. Anyway, I decided to go and find the place where it was invented, which is in Douarnenez in Brittany in western France. And then I made a whole trip out of it and explored Brittany and just had a great adventure, all just to find out where a pastry got started.
Whoa. So now this is Queen Amand,
and
it's
exactly.
made in a town called Douarnenez in Brittany. So hard to pronounce words, but probably not hard to enjoy to taste this delicious pastry. Just what is the pastry?
So it's kind of like a round version of a croissant. It's probably the same batter, but a little bit more butter.
Okay.
So when it bakes, it crystallizes into a really nice crispy crust on the outside, and then the inside is nice flaky dough, just like a croissant.
So how'd you know about this?
Well, because it started showing up all of a sudden in a bunch of restaurants in the U.S., I decided to Google it and find out what it was, because it also had this weird name, Queen Amand, and so found out that it had happened actually this baker in Douarnenez about 100 years ago, maybe. He ran out of pastry, and he just had some croissant dough and a bunch of butter, so he threw it together in the oven really quickly, and when it came out, people loved it, and then it somehow finally made it way to the U.S. to a bunch of restaurants. And so I just got curious about it. And now, actually, the Brittany website, there's a Brittany tourism website that tells you the best places to go and get this.
Try this
place. So I tried several of them when I was there. And, of course, they were all delicious, and it was fun to, taste the different ones and compare.
What was it like the first time you found a great Queen Amand in Europe, in Brittany?
Well, it was really fun just because I thought, wow, this is the original one. This is where it originally came from. And, they even had the place where the man actually made it isn't there anymore. But in this little tiny town of Douarnenez, there was a little, town square kind of, that had a mural that had the old building, a painting of where he was. and how it was invented. So in that area, they're very aware that it's become famous. Although I went to the tour office in that town, and they didn't realize it had made it all the way to the U.S. So they were very happy to hear that we were eating it in the U.S. as well.
Oh, my goodness. That was a good excuse to get over there to Brittany. How was the rest of your travel experience, apart from just doing nothing but eating kunyaman pastries?
Right. Brittany was just a huge surprise to me. The people were lovely. I didn't realize the Celtic connection. I'm embarrassed. I didn't know enough about history to realize it. So while I was there, I stumbled on an international Celtic festival held in a town called Lorient, which is very close to Douarnenez. So after spending the morning having pastries, I went to the festival afterwards, and I would never have discovered it, right, if I hadn't been out there after the pastry.
So this is a Celtic festival, and, you know, the Celtic cultures that we probably think of more would be Ireland and Scotland. What was a Celtic festival like in France? How did it feel Irish?
Well, actually, it really did. The music was very Irish-oriented, similar. Lots of people were in kilts. They were drinking Guinness. They had lots of different exhibitions up of different Celtic artwork, Celtic artisans making artwork, lots of musicians playing, and just a really very Irish feeling in the middle of Brittany. It was amazing.
Do you know about that term, the Celtic Crescent?
No, I didn't know that.
If you think about England, it is surrounded by a crescent demographically of Celtic societies. You got Scotland, you got Ireland, you got Galicia in northern Spain, and you've got Brittany in France. And they all have that in common, the bagpipes, the kilts, the what you think of as Celtic in Ireland or Scotland, it'd be the same in Spain and France in those Celtic societies.
Makes perfect sense, but I had not thought it. But I love that image of the crescent.
Oh,
and it matches what I discovered there.
It does. And it's just like, from a music point of view, in Spain, it's like river dance meets flamenco, you know. It's got that wonderful mix.
Great, yes.
I was just thinking, as I was here listening to you talk, there's so many times when you travel to a certain place because there's something that you really like that originates there. I mean, I love a salad niçoise, and I love to go to Nice and have a Nice salad.
Right.
You know, I love the insalata caprese, you know, the Capri salad, and that's, you know, from the island of Capri in that area. If you're going to have a Campari cocktail, you might as well go to the original Campari bar in Milan at the Gallery Victor Emmanuel. So in our travels, we do a little homework, and if you find something that's near and dear to your heart from a taste treat point of view, you can do what Becca from Arlington, Virginia has done. You can look it up and you can go visit it. And apparently, Becca, it was worth the trouble.
Totally, yes.
Nice. Becca, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Bye now. What are your passions that have provided a good theme for your travel adventures? We're hearing about it from listeners like you at 877-333-RICK. Or email us at radio@ricksteves.com if you have a compelling travel tale to share that we might use on a future open phone segment on Travel with Rick Steves. Jill from Stillwater, Oklahoma used that address and sent us this report. I never pass up a library or a bookshop, and in my previous life as a library professor, I designed and carried out study abroad for graduate library students. We visited the British Library, Cambridge Library, Oxford Library, and the School Library for the City of London. Wow, all in England. And then also in Ireland, the National Library and Trinity College Library in Dublin. I looked for specialty tours specific to famous libraries and bookstores, but could find none, so I created my own. The process was long, but I met lots of nice library folks, learned a lot, and actually enjoyed the process. Boy, that's a good story from Jill in Stillwater, Oklahoma. You know, did a lot of work, met a lot of nice people, learned a lot, and enjoyed the process. You can really have a lot of fun going to these amazing historic libraries. I once gave a talk to a group of librarians, and I wanted to show clips that I've filmed over the years from the libraries. And I went to our website, ricksteves.com, and I went into the Classroom Europe program, and I just typed in library. And I got clips from five different historic libraries, several of them that Jill has mentioned, and it cobbled together into a 20-minute little TV shows featuring libraries. And it reminded me there are a lot of beautiful and historic and inspirational libraries that are open to the public. And if we know where they are, they can make our trip much more interesting. Thanks, Joe, for the tip. And Justin's on the line from Bellevue in Washington State. Hey, Justin.
Hi, Rick.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So how have you tied in your hobbies or your interests with your travels?
Well, last year, me and a group of my college buddies utilized our enjoyment of whiskey and golf and went to Scotland.
Yeah.
And we made it all the way up to Inverness, played some of the windiest golf of my life, coming off the North Sea there in up north. And we all together rented a car and all took turns as designated drivers, popping around different golf courses and learning about different whiskeys at different distilleries along the way.
Wow. What a cool theme. I mean, a bunch of guys in a van and golf and whiskey.
Yes, yes, we are. And we're very responsible. Everybody took their turn and would be dry one day.
Because they've got zero tolerance on the road in most of Europe.
Yeah, we made sure that we were following the rules as best we could.
Well, that's good, as long as one of you is.
Yes, it was great. You know, we were able to really experience a lot of things. We went to a number of distilleries, but along the way, you know, we came across some of the incredible architectural achievements in Scotland, you know, from ancient stone circles to like Crossmorag, the Antonian Wall for stone walls from Roman times, you know, Dunatar Castle for kind of medieval times and for modern times, the impressive Falkirk Wheel.
Isn't that interesting? As you went through those different sites, I've seen most of them, and it is fascinating how you've got from different ages, and we're talking from prehistory to ancient Rome to the industrial age in the 19th century, all of these different slices of local history. And if you know where they are, you can let that, you know, make your trip even more rewarding.
Yeah, it's really great. And just being able to see those things and have great experiences like walking the old course, St. Andrews on a wet Sunday afternoon.
So what's that like? Justin, this is interesting because I'm not a golfer, but people who go to St. Andrews, it's like a pilgrimage. What's it like going to that first course for an avid golfer?
Well, it's really incredible because the course is really flat. When you go and see all the golf on TV and you go to the golf across different places in the U.S., all these funky angles and stuff, but it's just a really big open field with a bunch of holes in it for the bunkers that some of them had ladders. They were so deep.
Huh. And then you went to a series of distilleries. I would imagine you went to Speyside along the Spey River.
Yeah, we actually stayed in Speyside, and that was a really neat experience. One day we were driving around looking for some place to eat, and we stopped in the little city of Craig Alicky. Uh-huh. And went to their hotel and was really impressed by their whiskey selection at the bar that they had there as we were waiting to get our haggis meal. And then the bartender said, "Hey, do you want to go to the whiskey room?" And we thought we were in the whiskey room.
Whoa. Did you have to make reservations to the distilleries, or did you just drop in?
Well, we made one reservation, and we should have done a lot more because we tried to go to a number of the distilleries, and they just wouldn't accept us without a reservation.
Yeah, that's my experience in updating that part of our book was just you got to get reservations if you want to not be disappointed. Also, one of the highlights for me was the cooperage on Speyside. Did you happen to visit the place that makes the barrels?
Yes, that was extremely impressive. Watching how they did it, understanding the history, and, you know, I just said it earlier, but the history of it and how just making those barrels really affected society and being able to have that transcontinental migration simply because of the way that the barrels were made without access to or touching of any metal. It just kept all the water fresh and whatever you've stored in it. Fresh.
From an age before plastic and before modern casks and so on, it was just really if you ever know a person named Cooper, you know, that's there's a person whose family once made those precious barrels. I was so impressed by how frantic the workers were. Did you notice how fast they were working?
Yes, and it's funny because I think that came from the history where the coopers would get paid by the barrel. So the more barrels you made, the more you got paid.
Piecework, man. That's if you want people to work like a little hamster in a wheel, pay them by the piece. And they're all getting paid piecework. And boy, they were just working like crazy. So many cool things to see when you have a theme in your travels. And Justin, your theme, whiskey and golf. What a great idea with some good buddies heading over to Scotland. Thanks so much for your call.
Thanks for your time, Rick.
Okay, take care. Happy travels. Happy golfing.
Bye.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Casmara Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Monday Night Travel. It's a weekly travel party, and you're invited. Zoom in and have some fun learning about Europe's art, history, culture, and food over drinks and snacks. It's free, it's an adventure, and be careful, it can be addictive. Join me and my travel buddies over Zoom for Monday Night Travel. We're live every week, starting at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Eastern. Register at ricksteves.com and BYOB.